The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, researchers have revealed how an otherwise ordinary moth in Australia uses the stars to make an annual voyage. And a coalition of teachers' unions is suing the Trump administration over billions of dollars in frozen education aid. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Australia's bogong moth, at first glance, appears, well, pretty ordinary. It's a small brown insect with splotchy wings and feathery antennae. But the moth is known for its long-distance navigation, and a new study finds the moths use the stars as their compass during their annual migration. To learn more, I spoke with Eric Warrant, a professor of sensory biology at the University of Lund in Sweden.
The moth itself, the bogong moth, is a quite nondescript-looking little brown moth. I mean, in North America, you would certainly see moths that look very similar to this moth. But it's a very special moth for the reasons that we've discovered in our recent research, that it has a remarkable navigational capacity, which takes it during the spring to our highest alpine areas in Australia, where it spends the summer in a dormant state known as aestivation, which is a little bit like hibernation, except during summer. So they go to the coldest place in summer in Australia, which is our highest alpine areas. And this moth, as a result of this, has been well known to our First Nations people for millennia, probably. And so they knew about the aggregations of the moths in the mountains since forever, long before Europeans ever came to Australia. And they actually went to the mountains to collect these moths and eat them. And they had a long party for about 2 months where they arranged marriages, had tribal meetings, did intertribal business, all the normal things that people normally do when you go to a big market or in this case, a big feast.
Now, I am aware of some migratory insects like monarch butterflies in North America, which fly from areas around, you know, where I am in the Northeast. You see them in the summer. And as I understand, they go to the Southwest into Mexico and come back. But that's also over the course of generations. Now, how is this moth, the bogong moth, different than a monarch butterfly in how it makes their migration?
Well, actually, the thing it's most interesting is that they're actually quite similar and really rather unique, because there are many different species of insects that migrate in vast numbers, typically moving southwards in the Northern Hemisphere. If we talk about the Northern Hemisphere, they typically move southwards to escape winter that's coming, and then move northwards again after winter to return to favorable conditions during the Northern Hemisphere summer. But the monarch butterfly and the bogong moths share a very unique, almost unique behavior. And that is that instead of just simply moving from one broad geographic region across latitudes to another broad geographic region, they begin their journey across an enormous area, and they're all traveling in different directions to the very same place, an incredibly specific destination that neither of them have ever been to before. In the case of the monarch, as you said, this is a very restricted mountainous region in central Mexico. In the case of the bogong moth, this is a very restricted part of the alpine regions of southeastern Australia. There is another moth in North America that some of your listeners may be familiar with, and this is the army cutworm moth, or the Miller moth, as it's sometimes called, which makes a migration from different parts of the Midwest of the US and even some parts of southern Canada. And they're all heading to the Rocky Mountains, to regions of the Rocky Mountains there. And they're a very important food source for grizzly bears, actually, that know they're there in the summer, and they go up into the mountains and eat them. But there are very, very few examples of insects we know of that make this incredibly precise migration to a specific destination that they've never been to before.
Now, insects, of course, can't tell each other where they're going, or there isn't a mama insect telling a baby insect, you're going to fly here when it gets hot out, or you know, to escape the winter. You and your team did some interesting experiments to help understand where the bogong moth are wired, I guess, to know where to go. And that involved a flight simulator. But can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes.
And how you came up with this method to test your hypothesis?
Yes. Yeah. The hypothesis was that if you're an insect and needs to make a journey completely naively, and as you quite rightly said, it starts its journey without any information from the parents who have been dead already for months. The same is true of the monarch butterfly, actually. And so when they embark on this journey, they head in a direction that they've never been in before, and they just know this direction somehow. We don't understand exactly how, but they know the direction to fly, and they also know how far to fly, i.e. when to stop. And so we've been working so far on how, on this direction, how do they know the direction to fly in? We don't really know how they know, but we know at least how they continue to maintain this direction. And they do this with a pair of compasses. And these pair of compasses are based on the stars in the one case, which is the work we've been doing now. And also the magnetic field of the Earth is another compass. There are two compasses that they use. And with regards to the stars, the way we did these experiments is we created a little mini planetarium, if you like, where we projected the Australian night sky, the very same night sky that they experienced on the same night that we caught them, just a couple of nights before the experiment. And we projected this sky above them, and then we tethered the moth underneath this sky and just measured where they flew over a period of time. And it turned out that moth after moth after moth that we placed under this starry night sky flew in the appropriate migratory direction for that time of year. That is to say, towards the mountains during the spring and away from the mountains after the summer during the autumn. And they flew in exactly the direction we expected. And if we rotated this starry night sky by 180 degrees, the moths turned and flew in exactly the opposite direction, both in spring and in autumn. And if we scrambled the stars and we distributed them randomly on this planetarium ceiling below which they flew, then they were totally disoriented. They had no idea where they were.
So they have a map in their own heads then that they're following, and they may not realize. If you're a moth, you may not realize the significance of it until you get there, I suppose. Now, you
indeed,
also said,
yeah, it's true.
You had also mentioned they're not only navigating by the image of the stars, but also by a magnetic field as well. So can you tell me about how you determined that operating system too, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. So about 8 years ago, we discovered that the moths themselves have a magnetic sense. It was a whole other set of experiments. So we actually determined at that point that they could, in fact, sense the Earth's magnetic field. And of course, the first thing that pops into your head when you make a discovery like that is, well, what are they using it for? And clearly, if you're an animal that has to migrate 1,000 kilometers, or about 600 miles, if we put it into miles, then a magnetic compass using the Earth's magnetic field would be very useful. But we didn't discover that they could use it in that way back then, 8 years ago. But what gave us the clue this time was that we took our planetarium, well, not the planetarium, actually, the arena in which we had the tethered moth, and we took it outside and placed it up on a hilltop behind the lab under the natural sky, under the natural stars of the sky, to see how they reacted in normal stars. And we discovered that they flew exactly as we saw in the lab under in our little planetarium. They flew exactly in the expected direction for that time of year. But what was really interesting is on a couple of nights when we did those experiments, we had completely overcast conditions. So the stars were totally covered by very thick cloud. And blow me down, the moths continued to fly in exactly that same direction as they had been on the previous nights under the starry sky. And without the stars, of course, what's left? And the only thing really that they had to use was the magnetic field of the Earth, which, of course, is not affected by cloud.
Now, is there evidence, too, that a moth, if it's, say, it's cloudy out and they're following the magnetic field towards where they're going to spend the off season, if you will, that there will be any correction if they go off course? Is that something that your team looked into at all?
Not specifically yet, but that's something we're planning to do. So, of course, having two compasses available to make this long navigation, 600 miles roughly, then this is an awfully long way. And of course, there is plenty of opportunity for errors. And they probably make a lot of errors along the way. They go off course for a while, but then they find their way back on course. And this is actually thanks to a very, very specific region inside the moth's brain. And actually, it's inside the brains of all insects. It's incredibly similar in all insects, actually. And this little region is known as the central complex. And this is an amazingly tiny region of the brain. The brain of the moth itself, the whole brain also, is about a tenth of the volume of a grain of rice. So this little tiny region, which is known as the central complex, is only a tiny fraction of that. But inside that region is probably hundreds of thousands of nerve cells, all of which are wired together to take all of the sensory information that the animal or the insect is actually gathering. So this could be olfactory information, magnetic field information, star information, different kinds of sounds, possibly all sorts of different types of inputs. And it's making sense of those inputs in real time. And then it's calculating a course direction that it then sends as a signal to the muscles in the middle segment of the insect, which is known as the thorax. And this part of the body of the insect houses all of the so-called flight muscles, which are controlling the wings, and they change the direction of the moth. And so what this little tiny brain region, the central complex, is doing, it's continuously monitoring the direction the moth is currently flying and comparing it with that inherited migratory direction, which it has in its head, where it should be flying. And if those two directions don't match, then this central complex is continuously updating the error that exists between these two directions and calculating a kind of a correction signal to send to the flight muscles to say, hey, you've got to turn right or you've got to turn left by a certain number of degrees to make sure you get back on track. So that's what's happening all the time. And we discovered circuits in this part of the brain that seem to be intimately involved in tracking the stars and supplying the kind of neural basis, if you like, the nerve basis of this compass, this stellar compass that we discovered.
What do you think about light pollution and other ways that the stars might be obscured? Now, I understand also in Australia there are a lot of open areas with not a lot of buildings or artificial lights around, but with a backup system, with being able to sense the magnetic field as well, does it tell you that the bogong moths are also able to navigate not only on cloudy days, but in conditions where the stars may be less visible because of human-made light pollution?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And to be honest, so far we don't have a lot of evidence one way or the other, apart from anecdotal evidence, really. And that is that over the last 250 years of European occupation of Australia, obviously a lot of towns have popped up under the flight paths of migrating bogong moths out in all over New South Wales, southern Queensland, all over Victoria. And these towns, obviously, over the last 100 to 150 years, have become brighter and brighter and brighter. Interestingly, though, we've seen no obvious effect of numbers in the mountains that could be directly linked to those towns appearing and growing. And actually, even the most bright object that they encounter right at the end of their journey, which is the capital of Australia, which is Canberra, which is very, very close to their destination, actually. On some years, it happens maybe every 10 or 15 years. I think because of freak winds blowing easterly, that they get blown across the mountains over Canberra. And this is a town with about 500,000 people, roughly, and a lot of light. And they get attracted to the lights of Canberra. This is rather early in the season, in the spring, when they're just arriving towards the mountains. And then, of course, they get sucked into the houses, into buildings, and most famously into our parliament, because we have the Parliament of Australia there, a little bit like your White House and your Congress. So the moths arrive in their millions, or billions, actually, and they've been known to invade our parliament, and so severely that they short the electricity out,
Wow.
they blow up the lifts, and they've actually caused parliament sitting to be cancelled because they just can't deal with it. And the moths, they congregate in millions inside the building, cause all sorts of havoc. And they do that for maybe a week or two, and then they simply move on. And those years, we find them still up in the mountains further on in their journey, exactly as normal in the same numbers. It doesn't seem to affect them.
Now, with a small moth that, if you saw it, you might think is kind of insignificant, a little brown moth, but now understanding this amazing navigation that it does have, what does that just tell you about insects and invertebrates and the complex navigation systems that they possess? Could there be many other species out there that might be equipped with something similar?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, Lucas, that this is not uncommon actually among insects and indeed among animals. The bogong moth is the first insect and indeed the first invertebrate, that is to say, an animal without backbone, which we know that has this ability. But we ourselves, humans, also have this ability. So European and North American navigators have for hundreds of years used the sextant to use the stars to navigate. South Sea Islanders don't have a sextant. They can work out where to go just with the stars alone. And some species of night migratory birds also have the ability to use the stars as a compass to find their way. So the bogong moth is very special, being the first. But actually, to be honest, I don't really think it's the last. I think it's probably a very common ability among nocturnally migrating insects, like other moths, for instance. We've got no proof of that yet, but I think it's probably likely to be the case. But what it does tell me, apart from all of that, is that if you consider, as I said before, that a moth has a brain about a tenth of the volume of a grain of rice and eyes which are about 2 millimeters across, this is a phenomenal feat for an animal that has such a tiny nervous system. This is a journey that this animal makes completely naively. That, if you convert into body lengths, is the equivalent of a human circumnavigating the Earth twice without any instruments at all, apart from their own senses. And the bogong moth does this journey twice. And that's quite amazing. And that alone is something that just blows my mind. So it leaves me with a feeling of being extremely humble in front of the majesty of nature. It's just another example of how magnificent our world actually is, and the animals and plants that inhabit it, and the amazing adaptations that have evolved over millions of years to allow animals to solve extraordinarily complex problems. And not just big animals like ourselves with large brains and large nervous systems and big bodies, but even very, very small animals that one might imagine, at least at first, would have no abilities at all. But they do.
And Eric, where will your research take you next? What else are you excited to jump into?
I think the thing that really excites us at the moment is to try and understand how magnetic and stellar information are used together, how this information is actually integrated in the brain. And more importantly, we are hoping that the bogong moth may help us to solve the endless mystery of magnetoreception. That is to say, how animals sense the Earth's magnetic field. This actually is not known in any animal, even though we know that there are many, many animals that can sense the magnetic field of the Earth. We are not among those animals, I'm afraid, but many other animals can. But we have actually no idea what the sensory mechanism is for this. There are a few ideas floating around, but so far we've never found the actual sensor in any animal's body that actually receives and transduces the Earth's magnetic field into electrical signals that can be interpreted by a brain. That information exists in no animal. So we're hoping that maybe one day we can use the bogong moth to solve that mystery, which is probably the great last mystery, the great holy grail, if you like, of sensory biology.
Fascinating stuff. Eric, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me about it. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was lovely. Thank you.
Eric Warrant is a professor of sensory biology at the University of Lund. His research is published in the journal Nature. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. After weeks of delay, the White House recently announced it has released nearly $6 billion in frozen education funding. The release comes after a coalition of teachers' unions filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over the holdup. The funding that supports low-income students, English language learners, after-school programs, immigrant students, and teacher training was originally due to be released on July 1st. The White House says the pause was for a programmatic review to ensure the spending aligns with the Trump administration's priorities. I spoke with New York State United Teachers Union President Melinda Person about the lawsuit just days ahead of the release of the funding.
We have done this before. What is different, I think, in this instance is we are directly a plaintiff. Oftentimes, we are part of coalitions or our national unions are suing on our behalf, or we are writing briefs in support of state attorney general, things like that. I think what's different in this case is we're directly a plaintiff ourselves.
So the lawsuit is over $6 billion in education funding that Congress had already approved for school districts that's now being clawed back by the administration. Could you sort of break it down for me? What does this $6 billion in funding help support, specifically here in New York?
So the title funds that are being withheld go to instructional supports for students, particularly migratory students or English language learners. There are training and mentorship programs for new teachers. There are a variety of mental health programs and supports for students. These are programs that districts were expecting the money to come July 1, and it didn't arrive. So right now, school districts across New York State are scrambling to figure out what to do. They're contemplating layoffs. They are canceling contracts, canceling programs, and it's really creating a whole series of problems within our local school districts.
Not to mention that public school districts have already approved their budgets for the coming school year. Is it pretty much safe to say that these funds that they are counting on are already worked into the budgets, and then the money is going to have to come from someplace else, and there's not a lot of money to go around?
Yes. And I would say, you know, this not only threatens the delivery of these critical services to our students, but it erodes the trust that districts and community-based organizations place in the federal government when they say that funding has been allocated by Congress, right? We are now scrambling to figure out if we can continue to provide these programs or if we have to cancel them altogether.
What are some of the challenges and financial pressures that schools may already have been feeling even before this freezing of federal funds? What were some of the pressures and increased costs that individual districts may have been experiencing in recent years?
Well, right now we are bracing ourselves for potential cuts at the state level due to the federal Medicaid cuts that were included in the budget. And that is an unknown at this point, but we hear policymakers and experts talking about New York State having budget deficits in the realm of $10 to $15 billion, which we're concerned will have an impact not only on healthcare, but on education and all other programs across the state as well.
Now, with the nature of these cuts specifically to programs like English language learning and after-school programs and support and training for teachers, do these cuts particularly impact certain populations or certain areas of the state?
I would say it is across the state. There are programs that support rural schools, urban schools, suburban schools. No one is left untouched by these cuts. And I would say, though, that our most disadvantaged student populations will feel the greatest harm.
Do you have an idea of how much money per district schools are set to lose in New York?
I don't have a per district number. We have started to compile by title which programs impact which districts the most. But there has been some reporting that shows losses by a congressional district and the sort of 100 largest districts in impact, which we could share if you're looking for some more details.
Absolutely. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about the upcoming cell phone ban. The governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, has asked schools to come up with their plans to restrict the use of cell phones from bell to bell by August 1st. And as we're speaking, that's just over a week away. So how are schools doing? If you're in contact with members across the state, how are school teachers and administrators working to implement these plans?
So far, so good. I feel like I should knock on wood. We actually had an event yesterday with the governor and several Capital District school districts, and there's the union and the superintendent and principals, where they talked about the work that they've been doing since the law was enacted to come up with policies and storage solutions for what we're going to do come September 1. The governor's reported that over 150 school districts have already filed their new policies with the state, and that's growing every day. So by all counts, things seem to be going really well, and the local collaboration that is happening with school districts, parents, and community has been going extremely well.
And briefly, what do educators see as the potential benefits from a school cell phone ban?
Wow, there are so many, and to name only one would be hard. But I would say it's about connection, restoring human connection in our schools, academic connection, social connection among students and their peers and the educators that work with them. We believe that the entrance of cell phones into our school settings has really eroded what had historically been a safe space for kids to be kids and to grow and learn and develop. And we are hoping to restore that bit of childhood for 7 hours a day for our young students.
Melinda Person, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Melinda Person is president of New York State United Teachers. The frozen education aid was released on Friday. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1816. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.